This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Brent Voigtson, immediate past chair of the U.S. Grains Council. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Brent Voigtson with the U.S. Grains Council next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net. Providing individualized protection on more than 540 million acres of farmland, crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Brent Voigtson has just finished a year as chairman of the U.S. Grains Council. While there are many headwinds to growing markets for U.S. corn, sorghum, and barley, Voigtson says there are tremendous opportunities for U.S. farmers in global markets. Mature markets may offer an uncertain future, but new and emerging markets promise phenomenal opportunities moving ahead.
U.S. corn, barley, and sorghum has a fantastic story to tell. Folks globally want to hear that story. I think one of the really good examples of this was last fall we were in Shanghai for a big trade show. And when I say big trade show, you know, I know we can talk about Farm Progress Show. I know we can talk about Commodity Classic with, some thousands of people. But I want to say at this trade show, it was 600,000 to a million people came through. So being able to get in front of that many potential consumers in China was fantastic. There was a great sustainability message around U.S. corn that was received. Of course, China continues to be the number one market for U.S. baijiu. And we're also seeing more U.S. malt barley go into China as well. And those have all been great success stories, but it's not just China, you know, India, Thailand, Malaysia, Korea, Japan, you know, Senegal and Africa. There is a good story to tell on U.S. agricultural products and people are wanting to hear it.
Does the world get smaller when you're in a position of representing the U.S. and looking at customers around the globe?
The world gets very small, to be honest with you. And part of that is technology. You know, when we got the when you've got your phone that's connected at your hand and you know, using the apps, the sun never sets on where the Grain Council works, I think it's a good thing. And so the world gets very, very small very, very quickly. But I think that's a good thing because folks don't want to do business with strangers. They want to do business with someone that they have a connection to. And we've been able to not only travel the world, you know, I should say that while I was able to do a fair amount of travel, we also took trade teams globally as well from the United States. We put farmers in front of, importers and buyers all across Asia, in different parts of Africa. Hearing that direct farmer story is very, very impactful, and it makes the world a smaller place. But then we would also bring trade teams to the United States as well. You know, our members would host them on their farms, you know, in Iowa, North Dakota, Kentucky, all through the United States. And those connections, they do make the world small, but it also opens up the potential for new markets.
So what are some of the questions that global customers want to know about U.S. farmers and U.S. agriculture production? And on the inverse, what are the stories that you really want to tell and points that you want to drive home with them?
As you can imagine, as the day is long, there's that many questions. They can be everything from production methods and techniques to technology use to why do you grow this? Why do you grow this crop? And our farmer members do a fantastic job of answering these questions. But sustainability seems to be the underlying driver in all of these questions. I think one thing that I've seen is the success of the sustainability story that we have for U.S. corn, sorghum, and barley. With corn, we've started our corn sustainability assurance protocol, which this is a certificate of sustainability that exporters and importers of U.S. corn can have when they receive that shipment. If their customers, if that's something that they can use with their customers, that's what we provide. When you start looking at the water success story around U.S. sorghum, and how it is a more water-friendly crop when you get into some of those arid regions in the West, and especially that plays well in Africa where you do have water issues and challenges. And so the sustainability aspect that we've seen and the sustainability driver of the questions that we've seen, they've all been very, very good back and forth.
When I think about sustainability, I think the leader in demanding that is Europe. And now that they are beginning to put teeth into some laws that they have previously approved, will the U.S. have a story to tell to Europe? And will it be an open door for us that might be a challenge to other suppliers like Brazil and others in markets like Europe?
I hope so. Like I said, the CSAP program, the Corn Sustainability Assurance Protocol, that's not just something that was just pulled out of thin air. That is in compliance with USDA, NRCS regulations. It has been benchmarked against international standards. So there is some teeth in that. And I think it's going to be a very, very attractive option for European importers if they want to talk about sustainability.
Do you ever share notes with the U.S. Soy Export Council or wheat growers or others?
So we do. We've actually done some events with USEC, with U.S. Wheat Associates as well. In fact, earlier this year, we put on a big ag supply chain conference with USEC in Thailand, where we talked about, again, the sustainability, quality, quantity of both U.S. corn and soy. We had them in different times, different areas, but we do work very closely with our other coordinator groups. Also, you know, it's not just U.S. wheat and U.S. soy. We also work closely with Meat Export Federation because, again, if they're increasing meat sales around the world, that's still U.S. corn and sorghum that is leaving the farm and grain with all forms. We also work with USAPEAC, which is poultry, because, again, when poultry and eggs leave the farm and go to foreign markets, they're still bolstering the markets for U.S. corn.
So, Brent, after working for more than a year, obviously, in the Grains Council, let's talk about headwinds, especially that you've seen over the past year. What are the challenges that U.S. grains are facing in the globe?
So I would say the biggest one is probably competition from Brazil. Brazil's come on very, very strong. And when you look at corn exports, it's United States and Brazil. I know there's other countries around the world that export corn as well, but when you start looking at the bulk of the exports, they're really going to be coming from the United States and Brazil. I think they're going to continue to be a competitive challenge. But when we get back to that sustainability message that we are seeing in our international markets, that's where I firmly believe that the U.S. corn production does have a leg up on that and with what we can offer. We're also seeing the fact that U.S. corn outperforms. When buyers buy that U.S. corn, you get the starch extractability, which is much, much easier than a Brazilian, which is a harder flank corn. And we've even seen some places where the importers, they prefer that U.S. corn because of its milling ability, because it's easier on equipment, it's easier on the electric bill because it doesn't require so much effort to mill it. So while I think there's some challenges there and some headwinds there, I do believe that the U.S. is poised to be very successful moving into the future.
One of the things that concerns many about Brazil is not only what they have been able to accomplish with regard to production, but the landmass that they have still available that they can continue to grow.
They do have a lot of land that could be, you know, put into production. I think all that's going to depend on, you know, you brought up some of the regulations around the EU earlier. When you start looking at some of those global regulations and how that's going to impact, when you look at the sustainability message, because you are seeing food companies, you are seeing importers, you are seeing that sustainability message become more critically important in sales. I think those are going to ultimately be what kind of settles everything. But, you know, I'll go back to it. That's where U.S. corn is uniquely positioned to provide that assurance of sustainability.
So talking about challenges, how about the strength of the dollar? Just from a pure economic standpoint, Even if the dollar value of a bushel of Brazilian and a bushel of U.S. corn were exactly the same, our currencies are nowhere near the same.
That is very true. And, you know, if I had a magic wand, maybe I could do something about that. And a strong dollar is sometimes a blessing and a curse. You know, the stronger the dollar, the less attractive U.S. exports are. But again, sometimes, as we all know, buying cheap isn't necessarily the best thing. And sometimes if you buy cheap, you get cheap. And again, when you go back and look at the starch extractability, the ease of milling that we see with U.S. corn and sorghum, I think at the end of the day, those are factors that are going to weigh in as well.
Not going to get into politics, but we're talking about trade. So one idea on the trade front is to try to get rid of tariffs. And the other idea on the trade front is to come up with trade agreements. And we have seen success in both areas. Do tariffs stand in the way, and do a lack of trade agreements stand in the way of finding new opportunities and markets for us, Brent?
I'd say yes and no. Sometimes finding those new markets is going in and sitting down and going through what needs to be done. And maybe a country finds out that what they need is more than what they thought, and you can establish things, you know, on the private side. They do provide that basic framework going back and forth, which, you know, having that rule book always makes things easier because you know where the footing is when you're getting into these agreements. As far as tariffs, they're a story as old as mankind. It seems like there's always been tariffs of some sort. I don't see them going away anytime soon. I think they're just something you have to work with and a cost of doing business, quite frankly. In a perfect world, I think we could all come to conclusions there, but I think that they are what they are, and you have to work with them, and hopefully we can get them down to levels that are beneficial.
The issue that we've had with Mexico over genetically enhanced crops has been well documented, but I would ask that from your perspective, is the world more accepting of traits in production because they find that not only in the U.S. but also in the Brazilian suppliers as well? Are we more comfortable with that than we were several years ago?
So, first of all, I'm glad you brought up Mexico because to your previous question, that's a good example of having an agreement in place, provided a framework for a dispute resolution. There is a dispute in Mexico around traded corn. There was a panel put together. That panel should be issuing its decision in November. And then as far as the traded stuff, the traded products that we see around the world, unfortunately, we are seeing some of that come from your more very affluent countries that have the ability to do that, that have the wealth to be able to pay someone to grow the food in a manner that they see fit. But we're working in markets where people need food. In some of my travels, you know, you see poverty, and you see poverty that you can't imagine. And people, you do see hunger. And when people need food, they need it, and they need it now. And that's what I think we do very, very well in the United States with our production is we produce food for people. Anything that we can do to help increase that food consumption, we will do.
The growth of the middle class in the globe would naturally lend itself to a greater demand for meat, and for meat, more animals, and that would mean more feed grains. Are feed grains still the forefront of our focus in the globe, or has ethanol and other products like dry distilled grains with solubles, have those also found a place and broadened the scope of the Grains Council?
So feed grains are still the main focus, because when you look at what we're seeing, Africa is a perfect example. The Grains Council has been a long time partner with a poultry training facility in Morocco, as well as a feed university in Tunis. But as you're seeing that growing middle class in Africa, they do want more meat. You're seeing it in chicken production. How do you increase chicken production in these places to meet that consumer demand when you don't have the feed grains? So obviously they need to bring the feed grains in. But on the flip side, We've also seen an increase in DDG usage because through these training programs in Africa, DDGs are a very, very high source of protein that chickens readily take into their diet, and they grow very well. But we've also seen it in Southeast Asia. We talk a lot about poultry when it comes to beef production, but don't overlook aquaculture. A large portion of the world, seafood is a big, big portion of their diet, and aquaculture is coming on very, very strong in Southeast Asia, and we're seeing more DDGs go into the aquaculture production in the region because fish love DDGs, and they do very well. They grow very quickly with DDGs in their diet, and you only get DDGs when you're producing ethanol. So, to get that ethanol out, to get those DDGs, it's all part of a puzzle that we are focused on.
So, ethanol, an opportunity, but also finding a headwind with Brazil and that tariff that's been placed on U.S. product being imported there. What opportunities for ethanol in the globe, and how big is that obstacle in Brazil?
That obstacle in Brazil, it is a challenge. Brazil used to be a very, very, very large importer of U.S. ethanol, and with the tariff there now, they are not. Brazil continues to be a challenge, but we're seeing successes globally as well. And ethanol is actually up 47%, and if that trajectory holds, we'll break that 1.7 billion gallon mark by the end of the marketing year in August, which would be an all-time record for ethanol exports. And the fun thing is that doesn't include Japan. We are shipping about 100 million gallons of ethanol to Japan a year, but it's in the form of ETBE. So when you factor that in, ethanol for refined motor fuels looks to be very good. Industrial ethanol usage continues to be strong. But there's also we're starting to see a push for ethanol as a cooking fuel.
Can you explain how ethanol works in a cooking fuel?
So what we've seen, when you look at India, parts of Southeast Asia, in Africa, they're still using wood, charcoal, animal dung to cook their food over an open fire. They're usually done in houses and confined spaces. You're seeing respiratory issues. You're seeing trees cut down because people need the wood to burn. But what we've seen is ethanol is an incredibly clean burning fuel, and it's readily, in comparison, it's very cheap. So we've been working in parts of Africa and India to encourage ethanol as a cooking fuel. And there are some companies out there that have ethanol supplies, and they've got it's a small two burner little stove top that someone can go a few miles away and get their ethanol for a day for a few pennies per liter. They bring it back, they hook the canister right into the cooking apparatus, and they have a very clean burning cooking flame that they can use.
Brent, let's look across the globe. Share some of the opportunities that you see from some markets that might be major, but even some smaller markets that added together would provide opportunity for U.S. growers.
Oh, happy to. China is going to continue to be a strong market. I don't see that changing as far as established markets along with Korea and Japan. I think they're always going to be reliable players. India is 1.5 billion people, and we recently opened an office in Delhi to start working in that country as well. I think there's going to be potential for ethanol imports into India. I can see some DDGs going in there as well as some corn going in there. There are some regulatory challenges that will have to be addressed, but I think India is going to be a very, very good market for the United States. That could be, we'll see where that goes. But I'm actually very bullish on Africa, East and West Africa. We've talked a little bit about it, but you are seeing an increasing middle class. When you look at West Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, you're looking at populations that are going to double in a very short amount of time. You are seeing stability in the region. You are seeing markets develop in the region. They're predominantly frontier markets right now. Last December, had the opportunity to go to Senegal with Grains Council, which is West Africa. Got to see some of the direct impact of our training programs, to be honest with you. We met with one of the big feed companies there, and one of the millers had gone through the training programs, and he was now that was the reason he was importing DDGs into Senegal for the use in the feed rations that they were mixing. But that's just one. Tomorrow will be two. The next day will be four. And that's how you get into these frontier markets. And when you look at a country like Senegal that is very stable, they can provide the access point to get into the countries around Mauritania with Ivory Coast, with Sierra Leone. These are all countries that are growing populations, and they want to see that more meat production in their diets. And it's going to come in the form of poultry and eggs and probably some other small ruminants as well. But we're there. We're the only folks that are working there. And I think we're going to be uniquely positioned to be able to provide the feed grains into that growing market. You know, I mentioned India was 1.5 billion people. When you look at the population projections for that West Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, you know, starting basically with Nigeria and going around it, I want to say I've seen population projections between 1.3 and 1.5 billion people in the next, you know, 15 to 20 years. So populations are growing. Nigeria is a very heavily populated country, and they're going to need that food. They want to produce it. They want to be able to produce that meat that's in demand, and that they know that the feed grains are going to have to come from the U.S. to do that. So I think there's amazing potential and opportunity there.
Brent, look over your shoulder over the past year in the chairmanship and look ahead for the opportunities and obstacles for the Grains Council and give us your observation.
I'm proud of what we've been able to do in West Africa, especially, you know, in Senegal to start getting our toe into that market, but also East Africa as well. We've been involved in Tanzania and Kenya, which I didn't mention before, but are also growing markets as well, and we are seeing more poultry production there, and they do understand the need for feed grains as well. The offices in Delhi, being able to get that office open and running and staffed up properly has been, I think, will pay huge dividends into the future for U.S. corn, barley, and sorghum. So there's been some very, very positive things that I'm very proud of in the past year. And looking forward, Verity Ulibarri from the United Sorghum Checkoff, she is the current chair now. She is going to be very successful. She has her agenda for the organization, and I'm going to be there to support her the whole way through on that, because at the end of the day, it was well said that a rising tide floats all ships, and that's what we're seeing. We're trying to raise that tide so that we float all the ships for U.S. corn, barley, and sorghum and affiliated products.
Well, hopefully you can give the suitcases a rest and get reacquainted with family and farm after.
Yes, I'm looking forward to not having an airplane meal, and I'm looking forward to not living out of a suitcase for a while.
Fair enough. Well, Brent Boydson, we want to thank you so much for your work on behalf of the U.S. grains industry. Thank you for taking time after your meeting in Utah to spend with us here on this edition of Open Mic. Brent, it is Open Mic.
Thank you. And
today, sir, you've got the last word.
So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. It was truly an honor to be able to represent the U.S. Grains Council over the last year. It is a fantastic organization, and I look forward to the successes that they have in the future.
Wonderful. I'm sorry to have nagged you so much, but I am so... Our thanks to Brent Boydson, past chair of the U.S. Grains Council, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.